This is John Radecki, February 25th, 1991. The mind-body split.
Given the events in the Middle East right now, I find that has a way of weaving itself into the talk. In fact, when I give a talk, I find that the events that happen just prior to the talk usually have a way of finding their way in. And it so happens that the background to the Middle East conflict is very much connected with this matter of the split between spirit and matter. And tonight, I'll probably only be able to approach the relationship between the two in a very general way. As a matter of fact, after I first got the inspiration for this paper, I began working on another paper which is much more germane to the Middle East crisis. Particularly, the title is The Role of the Psychopath in Healing the Split Between Spirit and Matter. So it's a development from a development from this paper, which I hope to give in the future. I was almost tempted to change the topic to that, given the enormous importance of what's happening in the world today in the Middle East, but I felt that this would be a very useful kind of introduction to the next paper. So I'll just go ahead with this one, and I think you'll begin to see the relevance of it to the current situation as we go into it. Tonight's topic is a development in my own life. I've given several talks here, and As I've given them, it's become clear to me that they all have something to, do with the relationship between spirit and matter. And over the years, it's become clearer to me that my own involvement in that topic goes very deep, and has started to show its way through in the talks that I give. It's not planned that I do that. I don't think about talking about this. The spirit-matter relationship. I'm just sitting in my office one day and words come. So, and then I prepare a talk out of that, and it always turns out to be about the relationship between spirit and matter. So there's a kind of fatefulness about this topic for me personally, and I'll be sharing, most of the talk will be sharing that aspect. Let me take you back to the early 80s, a little anecdote. In my own life, I was in Cambridge at the time, and I think we had just married, I'm not sure, but anyway, I was walking alone in Cambridge, and there was a psychic fair going on in a church, and I'd never been to one, and I just dropped in off the street and walked inside and decided on the spur of a moment to talk to a psychic. So I went into this room, and there were three or four psychics, most of them young people, and I was offered a choice. And I didn't know at the time, but I chose the wounded healer amongst them. I chose a young woman who had a very, very bad cold. And I didn't know at the time that I chose her because because she was more likely to be in touch with something because of her own disability at the time. And it turned out she was. We sat down together across the table, and she said, "Well, what do you want, tarot cards or a palm reading?" She was pretty versatile. And I said, "Well, why don't we just sit here together and you tell me what comes to you?" So she did, and she looked at my aura and described that to me. And then she said, "Well, you have to be very involved with the mind-body split." And that shook me. The mind-body split is another manifestation of the spirit-matter split, which I'll be exploring tonight. And that, when she said that, I was shocked. And I didn't know what to make of it, but it's turned out to be profoundly true. That turned out to be a true reading. I found in my own analytic work and in my own research and in the experiences that have happened to me they all fit very well into a very personal exploration of the split between spirit and matter. It's a huge topic. It's the topic that Jung spent his entire life investigating. It's put in different terms. For example, the process of individuation is an exploration of the split between spirit and matter. In order for Jung to encompass the vastness of the topic, he had to turn to hundreds of years of research in alchemy and try and distill something out of that. So he had to go beyond his individual casework to the historical field, the field of history in European culture, in order to adequately find a vessel that would help him understand what the spirit matter split was about and how that could be healed. So the entire Jungian psychology is a psychology that is rooted in that foundation, in my opinion. It's rooted in the foundation of our collective circumstances of suffering from the split between spirit and matter, and I'll explain what that means, and how that can be healed. It's very hard, though, to get a sense of how that works when you're working with an individual, because as soon as you come off the broad global descriptions that Jung offered, such as the alchemical descriptions of the development of Mercurius, for example, how the Philosopher's Stone comes into existence. Once you get off those broad ways of describing the situation and go into the individual, you lose all that. It's very hard to find a relationship between somebody's dreams in an office, say, and these very broad categories of description that Jung offered. One loses oneself in the forest. Von Franz showed a very good diagram of this in image form in the book Man and His Symbols, where she showed a picture of a stained glass window where from a distance you see the cross of Christ. But as you get closer and closer and closer, it becomes more maze-like, and you discover that the cross is made out of thousands and thousands of little mazes twirling together. And you can only get that when you're at a vast distance. So that's what it's like. When you get at a vast distance, as Jung was able to do, you're able to talk about the spirit-matter split and how it heals in global terms. But once you start zeroing in on your own life or the life of another individual, you get lost in the maze. And you wonder, what on earth can this dream I have to do with the split between spirit and matter? And it can get very, very confusing. So my talk tonight is an attempt to deal with that confusion. I'm going to spend the first part of our talk discussing in general terms what the spirit-matter split could mean in terms of our everyday experience. And then I'd like to share just a very personal journey, my own journey, going as far as I have gone, which may be little or may be far, in my own involvement with my own split, you might say, my own individual contribution to the split and its healing. So it'll be a very personal account, and I'm trying to use my own language so that you can hear how one man's language might have some relevance to the language that you learn if you study Jungian psychology, language such as the shadow, terms such as the shadow and the contrasexual aspects, the anima and the animus, and the grand concept of the self. I'll be trying to give you examples of those in a very personal way, so that you can just hear one person's adventure in it. And hopefully some sort of link will be made between my adventure and the larger issue. Now, for those of you who haven't met me before, In my talks, I like to talk fairly extemporaneously. I don't have a lot of prepared notes. And I do that purposefully because I like to hear if the unconscious wants to say anything other than what I've prepared. So that involves some element of risk that I may have nothing to say. Now, one way of getting around that is by inviting you to say things throughout my talk. So I don't like to just talk at you for an hour. I can get so lost in the material that I may lose touch with you. So hearing you speak brings me back. And so I'd very much welcome you to, if you need clarification on any point, if you want to add something, to just speak throughout the talk. That way it's more of an interchange that I prefer. Well, I just want to explore the title of the talk a little bit. The creation of new worlds and the role of the body in healing the split between spirit and matter. After I wrote that topic, sometime down the line, I realized, my God, look what you've put into the title. It's too much. So I'm going to try, nonetheless, to give you some taste in 2 hours of what Jung gave everyone a full meal of in 60 years. Now, I describe the spirit, let's start with the spirit-matter split, for example, that term, and see if we can just get a handle on that. I'm going to speak fairly simply. If there are any of you for whom this is a fairly new topic, I think you'll find this interesting, and I hope that those of you who are well-versed in the topic might find my simplicity refreshing. I hope you don't find it boring or simplistic. It's a central issue of our times, a central condition of our times, and to get a sense of how that is so in just a very practical way, I want to compare it to another world where the relations between spirit and matter are not split. So if we compare our world today with another world that existed, we'll get a sense of how our world functions through comparison. Now, some time ago, I was listening to a young woman in my office who was describing her pain. And like so many sensitive people today, she was feeling the effects of the environmental destruction occurring in the state of Washington with the forests. She lived on out Port Townsend way. And she had certain access to the local Native American people here, and she had some friends amongst the elders. And she told me that she had visited a Native American elder, and she was talking to her about the rapid loss of trees in this area. And the elder had nodded with eyes open, wide open, and she whispered this extraordinary statement. She said, "What will happen? Yes, this destruction is terrible, and what will happen if the tree people don't come back?" Now, when the young woman told me that, a thought immediately flew into my mind, which was, then the Native American elder and all of her people will be just like us Europeans, living in a world bereft of subjectivity, a world of dead objects. That's our world. The world that we live in, the world that we take for granted, the world in which we function is a world where matter is dead. Experientially dead. Now, it's quite one thing to talk to a tree as if it has a personality. We can do that in fantasy. It's another thing to live one's life on the conviction, not that the tree is as if it has a spirit, but that the tree concretely has a spirit. Do you see the difference? That's living in a different world. It's living in a fantasy world, imagining that a tree has a voice. It's another thing altogether to hear a tree speak to you. And on the certain occasions that's happened to me, it makes one's teeth fall out. Or it's a shock. Whereas we can investigate the as-if phenomena very easily. We're not shocked by that. So this Native American elder concretely lived in a different world. And it's a world in which spirit and matter were intertwined in a way that in our world it is not. She related to tree people. So, let's see. So when I talk about healing the split between spirit and matter, I'm talking about creating a new world. It's in that sense. The Native American elder lived in a different world to us functionally and experientially. And our world, in which spirit and matter are split, is a world where increasingly it's becoming more and more objectified. I've even thought, for example, of how much of the world is turning into money. You know, it's getting that, the dollar, you know, it's getting that much of an object. And it's losing more and more subjectivity. So the split is widening. Now, I've got my flow back now. The result of that condition in our world is what we can see. We can see the massive destruction of the environment. We can see the exploitation of natural resources. We see massive overpopulation because the natural attrition of the species has been interfered with. So all of these, as the Navajo say, Koya Anaskatsi, a world out of balance, this tremendous out of balance is following or is a manifestation of a condition that is thought of as the split between spirit and matter. Now, to try and give you a sense of how those manifestations, like the rape of the environment and the destruction of natural resources, is a reflection of the split, the way we get to that is by going to the myths of creation that we have in our culture. That's how we get to the fundamental a priori condition, if you like. For the Native American elder, for example, her creation myths are totally different from ours. One Campbell tells is of the buffalo, which had to be killed for food by the Native Americans, the Plains people. The myth, the creation myth of the society of those people, was based around a sacred covenant between the buffalo and the people. So the story is briefly that the people were killing the buffalo, and then one of their people, a young maiden, was captured by the buffalo people and only released when the people promised to enter into a sacred and holy covenant with the buffalo, which was that they're allowed to kill the buffalo as long as they honor the buffalo in ritual dance. Now that kind of a sacred covenant has its self-regulatory pattern. All ritual has a self-regulatory pattern which preserves the balance. You see. So her creation myth of her society is one based on self-regulation with the world at large. So there's an intertwining of the spiritual aspects held in the ritual and the honoring of the buffalo spirit, and the actual buffalo. There's a relationship between the two. Now, if we go to our creation myth, the story of Genesis, we have a very different situation where the Creator expels man and woman from the spiritual center, Eden, out into the world in which spirit does not reside. Now, that's how that creation myth, you can get a sense there that a man and woman are forever separated from spirit. The cherubim held guard to the tree of eternal life with a sword of fire. So we were not allowed again to approach the spiritual realm, and the Father God retreated and is now a transcendent God from the world of matter. So you can get a sense there of a split in our culture between the transcendent spirit as expressed in that creation myth and the rest and the world of creation, which includes us, that we are in some profound sense only matter. And there's no sense of any matter residing in heaven, and there's no sense of any spirit residing in matter in that story. And that our culture has become increasingly a reflection of that split. In for example, in the profound overemphasis of the scientific tradition. I'm all for science, but I'm all against the dominance of science. But the science promotes that view of looking at the object of inquiry as an object that is totally divorced from the observer. I'm aware of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle and how that's beginning to break down the subject-object split, but in general, when science is taught, that we're taught that you can observe something and be independent of what you're observing, so there's a subject-object split, and that's another manifestation of the spirit-matter split. So does that give you a sense of the relationship between how our world is functioning now and the central condition that I'm trying to get at, the split between spirit and matter? Would anyone like to speak to that or ask for more on that? Yeah.
It's interesting that in cultures in which that does not occur, that the divinity tends not to be as anthropomorphic. And I wonder if there's a kind of solipsism that happens when humanity envisions the divine as somehow quasi-human that prevents, you know, a broad enough vision to incorporate.
Well, the Greek gods were, if you want to use that word, anthropomorphized. They had very human characteristics, and they related with the human world intimately. So I don't think it's simply a feature of anthropomorphism that produces this split.
You don't
think the Greeks were split? No, I'm not a Greek scholar, but no, I don't. Because the gods, as far as I know, the gods interrelated with the human world very intimately. For example, corners of the room had a deity. The fireplace had deity, or was deity. The most ordinary objects had deity. The world was indeed deified, I think, in Greek times, as far as I know. I'm not a scholar. I believe, and I'm just resting on the scholarship of Campbell here, that the Judeo-Christian creation myth is rather unique. It's no accident, for example, that the world is poor. It's not.
Well,
with the idea.
Similar myths were present in that still present.
The original. I see. Now you're saying then that there was a constellation of myths in the Middle East that were dealing. Yes, that's what I was referring to around that period of time. That there's a link between punishment and expulsion creation, and apparently in pre-Judeo-Christian times that was very different. People were welcome to get the Garden of Eden. And it was the bounty was handed to them. You've raised a very interesting point that I would like to be corrected if I stray over my authority. If anyone has more authority on some of these issues than me, please speak up.
Okay. I was just going to say about the Greeks. I think you see the split starting there.
Oh, exactly. That's why Jung, all of his work was to do with union. Union. Mysterium conjunctionis. You know, the union of opposites. That's the bulk of Jung's work. How can this be brought together? It just can't be brought together by spirit and matter coming together. It's a collision. But how can they come together? That's what I'll try and explore right now. Okay, let me just go on a little bit with the examination of the title. The second thing I want to bring up about the title is the way in which I thought about talking about this talk. In other words, there's a relationship between the central condition that we're living in of a spirit-matter split and the very language we use. The very language we use almost or practically prevents one from saying anything different than, once again, manifesting the spirit-matter split. So there's a great risk of being incongruent in the talk, to the extent that if I'm talking about healing the spirit-matter split, but I'm using language that comes out of the split, then that's an incongruency. So I've had to work with that very hard here. I've come up with a way to do it, I think. But I just wanted to bring that to your attention, that the language, our language today, is the language of categorical opposites, such as light, dark. You're either in the light or you're in the dark. You know, like people say, is it dark now? Yes, no. High, low, metaphor, literal. Something's either metaphorical or literal. Concrete or fantastic. They're categorically opposite. Going into psychology, we have the categorical opposites of psyche, which is immaterial, and matter, which is non-psychic. This is one of Jung's great contributions, that he took our given tradition and brought of undeified matter, and he brought the opposite to consciousness, that of psyche, which is immaterial spirit, if you like. That's the opposite pole in one formulation. So he brought that, but in many ways they still function as commensurate opposites. mind-body is another pair of opposites that have become more and more categorical. And in using our language, our present language, the present formulations, the risk is that my language will betray the spirit-matter split. And how does one get around that? Well, the way we've tried to get around that intellectually is by introducing technical terms like psychophysical or psychosomatic or mind-body with a hyphen. Now, that only satisfies the intellect. That's not born out of an experience. That is still an expression of the mind trying to solve the spirit-matter split problem, and it can't do it. So I'm not going to use that language as much as possible. Jung introduced his technical way of introducing a concept to heal the split by, if you read some of his formulations, in some of them he has the opposite psyche and matter as opposites. And another formulation, he has psyche as a spectrum, where at the violet pole you have archetypes, the spiritual dimension, and at the infrared pole you have matter. So he is trying to, and he called the whole of that spectrum the psyche. So the psyche spread from the pure spiritual dimension to the pure matter dimension. So he was trying to wrestle with it conceptually too. But the point is, once you've had some experiences of a world in which spirit and matter are not split, ordinary language becomes fine again, except you can use the terms just fine, except they're incommunicable back to the world in which spirit and matter are split. You get lots of confusions. One of the best examples of that is Jung's own work with trying to describe the psyche to audiences who hadn't had his experiences. There's tremendous confusion. Another example that was a lot of fun was with Carlos Castaneda and Don Juan, where Don Juan dosed him up with peyote, and for to change Carlos into a crow, And Carlos found himself changing into a crow and flapping about half a mile down the block and landing again. And the ensuing conversation is hilarious, because Carlos snapped back into his previous world in which spirit and matter are split, and he tried to get some explanation from Don Juan. And the talk went something like this. Now, Don Juan, what happened? You changed into a crow and you flew. Now, wait a minute. Did I actually change into a crow, or are you using a metaphor? Was I really a crow, or did I run with my arms flapping? No, you changed into a crow and you flew. Okay, let's try again. If a third person had been watching, would he have seen a man flapping his arms, or would he have seen a black bird flying? You see how he's splitting? The world he came from can't handle that experience. Whereas for Don Juan, it's very simple. Perceptually, experientially, you changed into a crow and you flew half a mile. Very clear, very simple. But try and explain that in terms of the old system and you can't do it. So the whole point of an individual involvement in creating a new world, healing the split between spirit and matter, is that you've got to be initiated into it. You can't get there with the mind. It's an initiation that breaks the mind up, in fact, and I'm going to give you some experiences which demonstrate that. It has to be an initiation into new experiences governed by a new relationship between spirit and matter, and then the ordinary language you use refers back to those experiences which somebody with a similar experience can understand, but somebody without that experience can't understand. See, it's the original use of language as reflection of experience. So to a fellow initiate, you make perfect sense. Like the shaman's flight. Do the shamans really fly? Well, you know, you see a body there and it's tied up on the ground, so he's flying in fantasy. No. The shaman's flying. It's just that you don't get it. You know, those observers who saw that were governed by their own internal condition of splitness. So they asked split questions, or questions that manifest the splitness, like, did he really fly or did he fly metaphorically, you see, which is a measure of the split. The only way to the shaman's experience is through a direct initiatory experience yourself. So does that make it relatively clear? I'm talking about the relationship between the spirit-matter split and the language that it produces, and how difficult it is to describe another condition, another world, using the same English language. The language that I've chosen, which I think can best help in this regard, is the language that produces terms like the creation of new world. In other words, it's the language of image. I'll be using the language of image and symbol tonight almost exclusively to describe my own experiences, because that language excites the imagination and takes one past the mind. The Buddhists, for example, use language of image to describe the deepest processes within the psyche. They don't come out into conceptual language. They use beautiful, descriptive metaphor and image and symbol. And the idea is that symbol is to excite the human being and produce the energy necessary for the initiation. And that's the only point I can see in describing some of these experiences in this language, is that it excites you rather than clarifies or rather than explains. That's what the language of symbol tends to do. It excites and energizes and invites, and hopefully invites one to embark on the same journey. This is not for the purposes of explanation, which explanation reduces the unknown back to what you already know, whereas initiatory language takes one from the known into the unknown. So I'm not going to explain terms like body or flying. I'm going to just use those terms in the language of image and hope that stimulates something in you. to give you an example of how difficult it is to communicate such experiences, I want to tell you two short dreams I had, very short ones. One was I had a direct experience in a dream of dark light. Now, when I come out and try and say that, I find myself saying, well, what do I mean by that? Do I mean UV light? No, that's not what I mean. I don't mean light and dark put together, like there's a dark spot and there's a light spot. In other words, it's a paradox. One gets into the language of paradox. I had a direct experience of something, and the only way my mind, which has been conditioned by the mind-body split, the only way my mind can grapple with that is to say, well, that was a light-dark, that was a dark light. You see, which sounds contradictory when you use the mind to explain it. But if you use it as a symbol, it's meant to convey an experience that can't be grasped by the mind in any other way. So that symbol is meant to take me into it, not for me to extract out of it for mindful understanding. I'll never get anywhere with that. The symbol dark light has begun working on me profoundly. You know, I knew I had an experience of something, but what was it? You know, so it's going to work on me and take me there. And the other experience was I had a dream where I saw a tree and my eye followed the tree up to the top to a leaf, right to the edge of the leaf, and at the edge of the leaf I started to see the edge of the leaf disappear and I saw what seemed to be diffraction patterns emerging with the atmosphere. In other words, that dream was telling me that the boundary between spirit and matter was blurred. See, it wasn't just leaf end, air begin. There was a blurring. Now, it's very hard to explain that, but it's really excited me. You know, and it's taken me deeper into those kind of experiences where spirit and matter might be more blended in some way. So they're two short experiences that, you know, bring tremendous difficulty if you try and bring them out into what you already know. But if you take them as symbols, which they are, to take you into the unknown, that's what makes it initiatory, then you can have a lot of fun if you don't mind the unknown too much. Okay. Now the last point is about the title is that there is a relationship between the general condition of the split between spirit and matter and the individual. In other words, there's an effect of this general condition on each of us as individuals, and that's known as the mind-body split. And when one begins on the initiatory journey of healing the spirit, of contributing to the healing of the split between spirit and matter, which is the general condition, what you first discover is your own personal condition of being split as a person. And it's typically called mind-body split, or a split between conscious and unconscious. That's another way of looking at it. You discover in a very personal way your own splitness. And it seems that the deeper one goes into it, the emphasis in the psyche is towards healing that first. Before you can contribute to healing the general condition, you have to work on the individual aspect first. And this is what Jung called integration of the shadow and development of the contrasexual aspects, and finally the development of a mandala or a personal self. That work has to come before one enters the alchemical journey, if you like. So a lot of room for personal psychology there and integration of complexes. Yes. Yes, absolutely. It would be no exaggeration to say that we are trying to heal things in the world from being split ourselves, and how that can happen is beyond me. We just propagate the split because we're not working from a place of centeredness. We're working from a place of splitness within ourselves, and trying to heal things that way won't work. In my opinion, and facts seem to bear that out. Yes. Tell me. You mean they both work both on the general situation and the personal? Yeah, I like that. Yeah, that's nice. But if one consciously, I would add though, that if one consciously works on one's own material, you find that there is a primary emphasis on healing something within oneself. That connection with the larger situation can happen. But when that connection ends, the emphasis goes on the personal work once again, and that changes once there's a once one has found a relative place of wholeness. One doesn't have to work on it in the same way as before. One can work more directly on the general situation, and that's what happened with Jung's life. That more and more, as he got older and older, the things he did had more effect on the surroundings. And he wasn't doing personal work per se anymore. He was just having this resonating effect on the surroundings. The image of Jesus changing the loaves and the fish, to feed the 500. That's that kind of image of the relatively whole person has a kind of resonating effect on the environment. But for most of us, when you have a contact with the archetypes and the contact breaks, then there's need to do work on integration of personal complexes. It's what Edinger calls the lesser conjunctio. Or it's what in alchemy they call, where first of all the unions that occur are monstrous and they have to be broken down again, separated out. That's that kind of phenomenon. The union's not ready to take place yet because the personal work hasn't been done. So what you get is monstrous in the beginning. Okay. Now, the emphasis on my talk is the role of the body in healing the split between spirit and matter. It's a fact that all initiations involve changing the body. This is no exception. Throughout history, when initiates went through their initiation, it always involved changes in the body, and some of them were very painful. For example, replacing the insides of the person with crystals, and if you try and examine that from a split condition, you have to ask, do they mean metaphorically? No, they mean that he has a crystal body. scarification, loss of fingers, change of hair. In other words, what this seems to be saying is that changing the relationship between spirit and matter, the vessel is the body. It seems that the body is the vehicle which can contain both spirit and matter in some mysterious way. There's something about a nervous system, I think, that can do that. So the role of the body is paramount, I think, for a personal experience of healing the split between spirit and matter. Now, just adding to that a bit, I just want to say that healing the split between spirit and matter is not a whimsical thing. You just can't create anything you like. It turns out that if you follow the process of individuation, it seems that the healing wants to go in an archetypally determined direction. And we've tried to find ways to formulate what that direction is, and we come up with terms like subtle body or resurrected body or glorified body or philosopher's stone, which matches the spirit and the matter in a new way. We're trying to use these symbols to try and explore that process of just how spirit and matter want to come together. It's not something that comes from the ego. So I want to get away from that inflated view that we can create any world we want. Nature is intending. It seems our best guess is, if we follow the findings of depth psychology, is that nature herself wants to. They're peculiar statements, but they're trying to say something about the necessity to bring body into spirit in some way. So the role of body is very crucial to me in this exploration. And I found myself being intrigued in a new way with flying dreams. And I've had a lot of flying dreams myself in one way or another. And it turns out that I'm beginning to believe that flying dreams are key images for this exploration of the way in which nature intends a healing of the spirit-matter split. Now, I've just recently looked in Jung's collected works and other books to try and find if any work had been done on drawing a relationship between the spirit-matter split and flying dreams, and I've found nothing. If any of you know of anything, I'd be very glad to hear. But as far as I know, what I'm going to present tonight is, it's original, but I would like to know if it parallels anything that you have read or that you have explored. Yeah, I used that example of the crow, for example, with Carlos Castaneda. To fly, yes. The point I'm making, though, is that I've seen no research that conceptually draws the relationship between the split between spirit and matter and flying dreams. That's where I'd like to know if there's any research. I know there are lots of personal explorations of that, but I'm trying to bring them into relationship if I can. Let me start with a flying dream of my own, which demonstrates very personally how the split between spirit and matter manifested in me. As I was writing this paper, I recalled probably the only dream it's the only dream that I recall to date of my teenage years. This dream I had when I was 16 years old, and it turned out to be, my recalling that dream turned out to be a major stimulus for the writing of this paper. And the dream is deceptively simple. It begins where I'm trying to run in a race, and I often did run in races. When I did run in the races, I had this peculiar feeling that I wasn't getting anywhere. And I could rarely win a race. It was very frustrating. I mean, physiologically, I was holding my breath up, my center of balance was up and all that. But in the dream, I'm trying to run in a race. My eyes are on the goal ahead, but my feet are actually off the ground. And with all my mustered effort, I cannot move forward. I feel very frustrated. So that's a flying dream. And the way in which it demonstrates a split between spirit and matter is that the image, my familiar image of me, is off the ground, and my movement horizontally has no effect. I can't go forward. My will, I'm willing, like any teenager, but I can't go forward with my will. Now, in other words, my efforts have no effect. Where there is no effect, there's no body. See, we demonstrate body by demonstrating effect. You know, if something has no effect, it has no effect. Effectively, it has no body for us. It's only a fantasy or a wisp or something like that. But the way we explore the presence of body is through an exploration of the effect of something. If something has an effect, then we say it has body or we have body, something like that. Do you get the relationship between effect and body? So in this situation here, I was above the ground having no effect. Therefore, there was a profound way in which I had no body. Now, where was the body? Well, it was on the ground, in the mother. In other words, my psychology was that, like so many other adolescents, I hadn't been initiated out of the mother. So my psychology was effectively governed by the mother, and only a portion of my will had freed itself to be with the transcendent father, as it were. So I could study things like science and mathematics, but I really had no effect on the world. That all of the body, all of the matter was still in the earth. And there was the split. I was off the ground and the earth was there. Matter was all there and there was no body in me. So do you get the dream there? That it really showed, very showed. And there was no way I could think about it in those terms then, of course. But when I recollected the dream, I realized, by golly, there is the first image for me of my own mind-body split. And so what it meant was that in my life at that time, that my actions... Nancy. Yeah. What, yes, those, what our education teaches us is to free ourselves from the body of the mother intellectually. Well, we can have a certain freedom of spirit that way. But it's a, at least for me, it was an unembodied separation. In other words, I had no effect on the world. My actions were ineffective. And that was true for my early part of my life. My actions were largely ineffectual. I couldn't get where I wanted to go. I went through 4 years of undergraduate physics and failed my graduation there. Everything just failed. That was part of my initiation. I crashed. You see, what I... all of my attention was going forward on the goal, which is, that's good sound adolescent psychology, but it never occurred to me to look down. And so I had to be pulled down by failure. I want to compare that dream to another dream I had in the early 80s, which gives you a sense of how the relationship between mind and body has shifted. Now, I'm in India, in this dream, with Gandhi and another man. We walk up the steps of a temple. At the top, at the altar, which the altar is always the place where spirit and matter come together. It's where the ordinary food becomes sacred food. That's the point of conjunction. A moment opens up and a gap between worlds, and I fly. I leave the ground and fly. Arms outstretched, palms facing the ground, I float up and gracefully descend. I touch the ground again and again lightly. The ascent and descent is controlled in my hands as they feel Mother Earth's gravity. See, now there's a relationship to Mother Earth. I feel so light and yet in relation to Mother Earth, dependent on Mother Earth, but lightly so. So there's a big shift there. And I'll try and explore how that shift can occur. But that's a dream which shows that there's the capability of leaving the embrace of Mother Earth, but always with the knowledge that one depends on one's roots. Now, those of you who heard my Kundalini talk, I had the same emphasis there of developing from the bottom up without losing contact with one. One can get to the highest heights, but one must always be rooted at the same time. That's the image of the philosophical tree where the roots are very rooted in the ground, and then there's the bird at the top of the tree, or the serpent around the base, and then the bird at the top of the tree. There's a connection through the tree between the bird and the snake. They're not split from each other. So this is that kind of dream, where the, and it fits with my psychological work at the time, where I did a lot of work with my relations to the body and the mother, and developed a new appreciation for that relationship and a sense of healthy dependence on my own roots. So those two dreams are flying dreams that show both a mind-body split and some sort of healing that's beginning to happen. That's going to lead into what I'm going to say next. The question was, when one is working on the split between spirit and matter within oneself, or the mind-body split, does that involve at times an assault on the body? Which leads me right to what I'm going to talk about now. So I'll answer that question very fully. I want to tell you what happens when dreams that presage one's work on healing the split between spirit and matter, what happens when the effects begin to get felt. Now, when I was 16 and I had that dream of being in a disembodied fashion floating above the ground, running, trying to run, there was no effect. That dream had no effect on me at the time. I just had the dream. So I could not actually work on the split. You can only begin working on the split within yourself when you start to feel the effects of your dreams, because then the body gets involved. Once you start feeling the effects, then your body gets involved and you're entering the initiation. And that includes assaults on the body. Now, I want to tell you the dream I had in 1980, which irreversibly began me on this path, because the effects were so profound and ground-shaking for me. It's a dream which illustrates the psychology that lies behind within the condition of a split between spirit and matter, and it's the psychology of paranoia. And as soon as the split between spirit and matter begins to be shaken, you find a paranoid personality, or you find examples of paranoia. You find let's put it this way, I'm not a paranoid personality. You find the phenomena of paranoia, which is normal. When the split between spirit and matter begins to get shaken up, when the effects begin to be felt, then what you find lying within that tension of opposites is paranoid phenomena. And I'll give a dream example of how that appeared in my life. Now, this paranoia, this paranoid phenomenology, which you'll recognize in our governmental systems today on a large level, is basically a masculine affair. So this split between spirit and matter is basically masculine psychology that I'm talking about. And I hope I don't offend anyone by this, but I'm just telling you how I read it, and I'm not going to try and explain what I mean by masculine psychology or feminine psychology. I'm just going to tell you how I experience it. That for me, paranoia phenomenology belongs to the masculine psychology and belongs to the experiences that happen when that split in the masculine between spirit and matter begins to break up. This is what happened to me in 1980. I had this dream. I'm driving my motorbike over a bridge. A bridge is a place of transition. And I get a flat tire. I take it to a garage and lock it up with my other motorbikes. I then go to get someone to fix it. It's a busy garage. I return to my bikes only to find that they are gone. This is the beginning. I start to feel frantic. I grab people. They surely must know. My suspiciousness goes up. They look around as well, but there's no luck. I begin to suspect a conspiracy. You see the paranoid psychology coming in? I scream and yell. I see my leather jacket is in the back of the shop for sale, and at last some evidence. I take it and I triumphantly show it to the shop attendants. I grab the shop owner violently and I force him to show me where the rest of the bikes are. He reluctantly complies. We go into the garage and I'm surrounded by men. Even the attendants are in on the plot. They come for me and we fight. A young boy throws a pair of pliers at me. I catch them and I yell triumphantly, "These are mine, this is more evidence," even though I can see that they're not mine at all. Gradually we start to uncover bits of bikes hidden throughout the shop. The immensity of the plot against me shakes me to the bones, and my whole sense of reality is shaken. the whole bike was dismantled and the parts were separated throughout the shop, as if to say, no more. Now, at this point, a beautiful woman comes and she becomes my guide. We survey the wreckage of my life and the motorbike pieces revealed to me in the dismantled bikes. She takes me to a little grassy patch and we lie down together. As I touch her, she feels like pure energy. And this frightens and excites me. Who are you, really, I ask. She looks deeply into my eyes silently and I wake up. Now that dream, you can see the spirit matter split, like my vehicle for life, my image of masculinity is the motorbike. And it excludes all things feminine. It excludes a motorbike as pure machinery, pure object. And there on the other hand, you have the feminine figure who's pure energy. See, and she was only revealed to me after my masculine identity at that time, image in the motorbike, was broken up. But there's a lot at stake here. You just don't do that sort of thing lightly. This was forced on me. In our culture, men are taught to develop a masculine identity that excludes femininity. In other words, to be a man is to be utterly male and exclude feminine. See, there's a split. So all things feminine, all things to do with nature, body, are excluded. And man is left, therefore, with a vehicle that's purely mechanical. So our healing, our major and dominant healing practice of medicine is based on that masculine model. In other words, medicine has become more and more technical and more to do with the machinery of the body. So you can see that that kind of healing principle promotes the split. It does not heal. It works with the machinery, keeps the machinery going. Now that's how we've got this tremendous unbalance in the normal attrition of life. It keeps the machinery going, but does not heal the split. So the masculine identity, I rode motorbikes for about 10 years. And thought of myself purely as being man and being unwoman. The woman was excluded from my psychological inventory. And that meant that I saw myself in some way as being mechanical, like that motorbike. Now, for anything to change, that had to change. And so this dream presaged that change for me, where that identity got broken up and hidden. The motorbike was dismantled and hidden from me, and that revealed within it a paranoid phenomenology. It's not quite paranoid phenomenology when you can get images like that, because the reference is there. What makes it paranoid, as it was for me, is that you project the phenomenology onto the world and act as if people are against you, and which is what I did. One profound paranoid experience I had around this time in Venice, Los Angeles. I was just newly in town when I had this dream, and I remember walking through a narrow alleyway out onto the Venice Boulevard, where people in their hundreds ride roller skates, and I had the unshakable conviction that they were all riding towards me to knock me over. Now that's an example of the paranoid phenomenology that begins to emerge. I had a long struggle of paranoia with the INS, the Immigration Service. If you don't hear me talk, I look American. I've got blue eyes, fair hair. I don't look Mexican. I'm not going to be picked up from the street. But all of my behavior, this was before I got my permanent visa. I stayed in the country illegally for a few years. But all of my behavior was paranoid. So in other words, this dream had its effect. My masculine identity, as I knew it, got broken up and revealed paranoid phenomenology. And that was expressed in my outer relationships. I was very suspicious, very easily roused to violence, hostility, attacking people. manically triumphant. You know, yes. Here's the description of some of the phenomena of paranoia. Rigidity, I was very rigid in my opinions. Suspicious, impugning motives to others on the slimmest of evidence. Illogical, yes. Mirthless, I had no humor at the time. Self-important, yes, I believed I was either worth nothing, which is a negative inflation, or that I was, you know, bloated importance. Grandiose ideas that admit of no alternative, I was very much that way at that time. With a growing sense of panic, which permeated most of my actions at that time, and also being dreadfully literal about things, which also fit my profile at that time. So the effect of this dream was quite devastating. It really, in a very real sense, broke me up and revealed a phenomenology, but without the persona. You see, the other thing is, when that masculinity breaks up, there's no persona, so you can't function effectively in the world. So I was like without a mask. So I'd be at work, and somebody would say something, and I'd get enraged. You know, I'd have no sort of personality to kind of mediate relations. I'd just be a raw psyche with this paranoid phenomena running through me. So I was very difficult to be with. And yet that seems to be, I don't think this is an idiosyncratic dream, I think it is also a function of what happens when that split between the spirit and matter in a man begins to break up. So that was an assault on the body, all right. I had lots of, I began to feel my body in new ways. I began to feel how I would run my body like a machine. You know, I got a hiatal hernia, and the tendons in my knees and elbows started, you know, it was just terrible. So because of all those years, I just treated it as a machine. Exactly. Which is the point I want to get to now, that as well as this wreckage of a life, other things begin to happen. The what begins to happen next is that all those elements that were excluded from one psychological system begin rushing in for attention, such as the anima, the feminine, begins rushing in all sorts of ways. The mother returns in full force and fury for having been neglected for so many years, and that's another assault on the body. And other all variations of femininity arrive to shock and comfort and dismay the nascent masculine personality. So the feminine comes in for attention, the body comes in for an attention in a new way, nature comes back in a new way. So many, many animal dreams at that time arrive. What's more, the shadow, those excluded aspects of one's masculine identity come crashing back in. In other words, one gets faced with tremendous moral problems. One realizes, for example, one's paranoia, one's suspiciousness, or one's intimidation of others, one's violence against others, all those things that might have been excluded from the happy identity of yesteryear, come back claiming their attention. So it throws one into tremendous moral difficulties, contrasexual revelations that shock, and new connections to the animal body. So the interesting thing about animal dreams is that they seem to, in the face of this destruction of the old personality, which again is a hallmark of initiation, the animal dreams all had this motif of animals wanting union with me. So a typical dream would be being along the beach and or being in the water. Here's one dream of being in the water with a woman and seeing a whale come And my response to the whale was utter terror, which is a kind of the flip side of a heroic attitude, which would want to slay the whale. You either slay the whale or you're terrified by it. But the woman in the water had a religious experience with the whale. So the whale surfaced, and I saw the eyes of Osiris on the whale. And the woman, in the midst of my terror, I experienced the woman in the water having a religious experience, which is a new relationship to the animal power. Had many dreams like that, of bears, for example, coming towards me and me sort of shrieking for cover, and then the bears romping with me, playing with me, or wanting food from me. In other words, it seems that when the old personality, the old masculine personality breaks up, the animal body or the animal nature wants to come back and is seeking union with man again in a new way, seeking intercourse, commerce, where the animal nature is not seen as an object to be conquered anymore, but more as a companion. There's some very, very beautiful Celtic myths that point to that phenomenology, that instead of animals being something to conquer or overcome, animals were seen as a companion. There's a wonderful story of Owain, in which he has animal companions, where they have their original wildness. They're not domesticated, but they help man on his journey of individuation without losing their wildness. And that's the kind of experiences that begin to emerge with the animal kingdom. Yeah, you had a question? I would say, insofar as women are subjected to the masculine psychology of our times, they would be subjected to the effects of the spirit-matter split. But there are some profound differences in my experience of working with women. There are profound differences between men and women's responses to it. With men, it seems more to be an identity with the spirit-matter split, so that when it breaks up, the man feels like his total identity is shattering. Whereas with a woman, she has an identity that's different from that. So she more feels, she's more liable to get in touch with her femininity as experienced by femininity, not experienced by masculinity. She's more likely to get in touch with that and feel the effects of the spirit-matter split. So you have something to go to that men don't. So it's a different kind of response, that a woman has something to go to, which is sort of a deeper experience of herself, while feeling the suffering of the effects of the masculine psychology, whereas men feel like their identity is falling apart. That would be one way that I've begun to articulate the difference. Yes? Right, good. You keep presaging my... No, it's wonderful. You're very, very intuitive. You're right. I like that. We're connecting through the unconscious, clearly. Yeah. I want to go into that at quite some depth, because it's not enough just to have dreams. In order for it to be initiatory, it's got to affect you in waking life, like I've tried to describe so far. But let me go on with that. I just want to tell you a couple more dreams that I had involving the body and involving flying, and then I want to tell you about some of the waking experiences I had, that I began to have. It's when you start having waking experiences of the healing that it start, the whole process starts to get integrated in actuality. Betty. Yes. Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. In women. In the moment. Yes. Uh-huh. Got you. Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. Hmm. Oh, thank you. Yes. One way is to remember your reaction, the shock, or whatever you had. I would, if it was, if an antelope, you treat it with reality, with it being as real as anything else. And when that antelope comes towards you, you would experience something like a shock, which would bring a certain enlivening with it. So carry that experience into your waking life. When something from the animal world approaches you, do you feel enlivened and shocked? Then the dream starts working on you in that way, and you start to explore how it can change your connection to the animal world in actuality. Presumably the dream is approaching you that way to wake you up to it. You know, 'cause apparently, so maybe you, in actuality at this time, need those kind of fast approaching experiences to sort of bring you into awareness that they're there. So you could explore that possibility in your life. You know, is that how you get in touch with the animal within you or within all of us? Is it that kind of shocking, abrupt experience that does it? Is it? Not only with animals, but with animal experiences. Experiences of the animal in each of us. Like it does, yeah. Okay, so that's the dream. It's... Let me tell you a couple of dreams now about the changes that occur in body over time. I had many dreams of wind, and the effects of the wind in the dream were to blow me around. In other words, the wind would pick me up and throw me against a wall, or would break down a house, or would fling me about or fly me up into the air. So in other words, that's an image for a relationship between spirit and body, where the body is very corporal, very physical, and the spirit is blowing it very, very... in all sorts of directions. So, in other words, I was being blown about by the effects of my personal research. I was being blown about in all directions. This changed around about the time I had this extraordinary dream, where I'm sitting at a table, and a huge wind begins to buffet me. I start shaking as it gets stronger. And I reach out and grab a Mani stone, which is a Tibetan stone with Om Mani Padme Hum on it. A little stone like that, and I grabbed it in the dream. It means praise to the jewel in the heart of the lotus. It's a prayer. So I grabbed the stone, and I began to chant over and over Om Mani Padme Hum. Getting in touch with the center, I guess. As over and over, as the wind reaches a crescendo, and I hear in the background a group of Tibetan monks supporting me, chanting too. The wind abates and I survive, still in the chair. And then when I woke up, I realized that the wind, in fact, pervaded my body. It went through my body. There was still terrific force, but it went through my body. And I had to ask myself, is this a subtle wind, or is my body gone subtle, become subtle in some way? Is this, in other words, has the body become less gross, so that the wind can interact in a new way? Or is the wind subtle? See, it's an ambiguous question. And that in itself signals a shift in the split. Ambiguity is one expression of a shift in the split. There's no longer either or, there's ambiguity. It's both and, maybe. Both this side and that. So that kind of resolution to the dream, is my body subtle or is the wind subtle? That ambiguity presaged a shift in the split. And so that dream is a dream of the possibility, anyway, of an experience of subtle body. Now, to Two other. Let me. Yes, please. One question. Yes. I'd like to hold it off till the end. Could we do that? I think that would just shift me a little bit off. I'm just getting a little concerned about the time, so I have to work up to a major point. Do you mind holding off? I don't mind doing it privately either afterwards. Okay. I want to give you two flying dreams now that, again, are different from that early dream I had at 16 and clearly show the possibility of a marriage between spirit and matter. First one is, I'm with an old man from India, and it's night, and I'm in his bed, and I feel some quivering in my abdomen. As soon as I do, I faintly hear him say, "Yes, the chrysalis is cracking." Then I know that I've become a butterfly, and I emerge in the dream, I emerge out of the chrysalis as a butterfly. And I flap unsteadily up into the sky, because I'm not used to this, and I look through my butterfly eyes. And I land in a backyard, and I see our cat there, and he playfully romps about. And I follow the cat around, and this time I feel a little bit of fear of being eaten by a gecko lizard, which are plentiful in India. See, that ensures the presence of body when you're afraid of being eaten. These kind of limitless, costless flights that people talk about, that's not with body. If you start having experiences of flying or experiences of spirit with body, then that brings the fears of the body. Fears of not getting back, fears of getting eaten up, fears of getting lost, that all involves body. So I surrender to the old man who guides me into the room to his bed where, fluttering, I see a young couple sleeping. So in that dream, I actually became a butterfly. And so that's an image of some experience that wants to make itself available to me where flight is possible. I mean, the butterfly is a perfectly natural animal that flies, so it's a natural, it's an image of spirit and matter being married in a very natural way. For example, societies that honored the animal, eagles and birds were seen as spirit. You know, not as signs of spirit, but as spirit. So that there was a very natural way in which spirit and body were married in the animal. You know, they'd have the totem poles of the animal spirit. This dream, I think, is pointing me in that direction through a personal experience of it. And the next dream I had a few nights later was once again in India, and the grounds are surrounded by old sandstone buildings with that yellow color in the air that's common in India. And it's a big house, and now it's nighttime, and I become again, in body, totally an eagle. And I can fly like in the butterfly dream. It feels new and strange. At first, I tentatively try out my wings, flapping cautiously about. I begin by flapping my arms or jumping off a ledge. And then the dream goes on with some things that the eagle does. So that's another experience of becoming an animal and flying, which is so different from that 16-year-old dream of sort of being in a disembodied state in the air. This has body. One can go somewhere now. I'll just tell you those dreams without saying too much about them, because there's a main point I want to get to here. The point is this, that, as I said before, it's not enough to have dreams like that. In order for those changes in the mind-body split to become actual, one has to begin to have some experiences in actual waking life, which is what your question was. So I wanted just to share a couple of experiences of that to you, with you tonight, just as one very personal example of how it can happen, of how how the effects of a different world in which spirit and matter, or the mind and body, are more together, how that can be made its way, make itself felt in my everyday world. One example lies with the eagle, one day I was sitting with my analyst, and he has a window which overlooks nature, and I was talking with him about a problem I was having, and I couldn't get the insight I needed. I needed a certain insight, and I couldn't get it. And then an eagle flew up in the air outside the window, and I just saw it hovering over there. And the next thing I knew, it was like an experience of being up there looking down, and the eagle gave the insight. Cool. I came back to my chair, and I had the insight. That's what I needed. So I thanked the eagle. Another experience I had with the eagle in waking time sprung from a dream I had where Native American medicine people were sitting very, very depressed, and it's like they'd given up healing based on the effects of the white culture. They saw nothing more they could do, so they're very depressed. And in the course of this dream, I changed into an eagle and I screeched at them, and that woke them up. And there's something about that eagle energy that wakes up the healing power that's native to all of us. And I've had some experiences of that in waking time, which have been very unpleasant on one level to other people, but it does wake things up. The experience I remember was I was sitting at a staff meeting at a university I was working, and the staff was sort of talking about what they were doing with the students, and I was feeling sick that day. I had the flu, so I was feeling my conscious level was very lowered, and I was only listening to it, and it was mumbling. People were mumbling, and the energy sounded depressed. And one woman was talking about what she was doing with the students, how she... these were first-time students in therapy, and she was giving them kind of meta-theories of psychology which were undoing everything that they were trying to build up. They were trying to build up some theory of psychology, and she was giving them examples of people's research which were undoing those theories. So the students were getting undone. You know, you don't teach counterexamples till somebody has an example really firmly built. And so she was talking about that and how the students were troubled. And out of my sickness, I just screeched at her. I said, they're building a foundation and you're undoing it at the same time. And then I fell back into my flu. Well, she was shocked. But it woke the group up. And I realized that was the eagle. It was kind of a screech that penetrated something. And it didn't come from the ego. It was just a screech, and then it felt like the effect of it was like a screech with that kind of insight, and then I just went back to being my ordinary sick self. But it was definitely the image of the eagle superimposed on that experience. Another waking experience I had, which really taught me a lot about subtle body experiences, was one day I was sitting in my office. Let me see if I can just recorded this one. One day I was sitting in my office waiting for my next person, who is a young man who is, amongst other things, recovering from alcohol abuse. As I was sitting there, I lapsed into a dreamlike state, and suddenly my door flew open and a violent man stormed through. I was shocked, and my first thought was to the safety of my wife and son. I next, in this vision, leaped through the window to escape, when suddenly I was back in my chair saying, no, 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 I must face him. And then I returned out of that state back into my office, and there was just me there. So there's this image of a violent young man storming through the door and attacking me, and I wanted to flee, but I felt I had to face him, and then that ended the vision when I was back. So that was very palpable, but I couldn't connect it to anything. But the effect was there. There was some subtle body came through and affected me. A few minutes later, the young man arrived, and I still made no connection. And as we went into the session, he gradually became emboldened enough to tell me that on his way to see me, he had become enraged by the slow traffic. And so I thought, now I know what my experience was about, was in relation to. At least it's highly suggestive. Synchronicity. He had come to me, as it were, enraged. And perhaps he had come to me before he had arrived. And perhaps I had to find some way to contain his rage so that he could come into the office in an ordinary way. You know, it's suggestive. But definitely, the phenomenology of subtle bodies right there. You can explain it how you want, but the phenomenology was incontrovertible. Now, lastly, to finish up, I want to tell you a very profound experience I had, which actual experience that conclusively showed me the presence of a new world in which spirit and matter may be wedded together in some mysterious way that we can get a sense of if we go into this work in an initiatory fashion. It's a disturbing vision, but it tells you very, very well what kind of experiences become available, what the character of the experiences that become available.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU and Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.